This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they live on the earth. And this broadcast is also important for all people, for we all face the specter of Jewish extremism. We're seeing the importance of confronting and identifying the powers of Jewish extremism and really Jewish supremacism. Right now, we're seeing a massacre. We're seeing a catastrophe in Lebanon. And it's not only a terrible catastrophe for the Lebanese women and children and men and old people and so forth that have been murdered and crushed and disfigured by this incredible Israeli onslaught. It's also a disaster for the American people in terms of American interests and policy. Lebanon actually was an ally to the United States of America until this happened. There were 25,000 Americans living and working there and developing business interests in that country. Israel attacked the nation even while Americans were still there. It's certainly against any sort of interest of the United States. And I must tell you, the same thing is true in Iraq. I'm against the war in Iraq for humanitarian grounds, of course, but as an American, I'm also against the war in Iraq from the standpoint of our American interests. I don't think American boys should be suffering loss of life and limb, and there are literally tens of thousands of Americans who are suffering terrible maiming in this conflict, disfigurement that will last the rest of their lives. They're losing arms and legs and eyes, their ability to walk, even perhaps the ability to father children when they get back home to their wives and families in this conflict. And it's a horrible scene, and it's a scene that's being played out not in the interest of the United States of America at all. It's making America hated around the world, and it will certainly increase terrorism against the United States of America. I believe you're going to enjoy the continuation of the spoken word version of Jewish supremacism. I'm now in Chapter 7, The Roots of Anti-Semitism, Economic Exploitation, and I think it's very vital that we begin to understand some of the basic principles of one of the key issues of our time. We've read a lot about anti-Semitism. You've heard the word bantered about quite often in media, government, books, magazine articles. Well, what is anti-Semitism? And who truly is defining anti-Semitism to our people? Today I'm going to begin by talking about usury, but I'm going to go into some of the Jewish team strategy, the economic activities, the bank and stock exchanges, and some of the history of some of the Jewish, and I would say chauvinist, economic activities that have caused the reaction that's referred to as anti-Semitism. A reaction, of course, that Jews and Jewish writers always say had no basis in reasonableness or in decency, but was simply a pathologic experience or a pathologic result of defects in our people. In effect, anti-Semitism, as what they allege that Gentiles have committed against Jews, is a blood libel. They're basically saying that we have this terrible defect in our personalities, and we're just nothing but hateful mass murderers, and that Jews are always innocent and Gentiles are always guilty. It is a blood libel. So I hope that this chapter will help give you a good understanding of this issue. So today, this is the second part of The Roots of Anti-Semitism, which is Economic Exploitation. It's Chapter 7. Chapter 7, The Roots of Anti-Semitism, Economic Exploitation, and this is Part 2. I begin with a quotation from Immanuel Kant. Jews are a nation of usurers, outwitting the people amongst whom they find shelter. They make the slogan, "Let the buyer beware," their highest principle in dealing with us. The philosopher Immanuel Kant was not the first Westerner to make the charge that Jews are a nation of usurers and that their economic practices were often exploitive. Since the Israelites sojourned in Egypt, non-Jewish politicians, theologians, and chroniclers have spoken of Jewish avarice and exploitive practices. Even Shakespeare immortalized the Jewish usurer in The Merchant of Venice through his character Shylock, who in the absence of the money due him, demands the Christian's pound of flesh. There are numerous examples of medieval governments receiving huge percentages of their revenues from the taxation received and the profits of Jewish usury. In the diaspora, the Jewish people living outside of Palestine, there is a pattern of Jews being employed by Gentile kings and governments as tax farmers and revenue collectors, and of their being utilized as administrators of foreign occupational governments. By their very nature, farming and ranching require periodic infusions of capital. Diseases, insect infestation, and natural disaster can place those who cultivate crops or animals at the mercy of those who have ready money to lend. This is especially true among those who draw little more than their essential sustenance from such pursuits, which was true for most people from ancient times to the modern era. Historically, such needs for capital were often provided by cooperatives and intervention by the civil authorities, but more often such needs went unanswered, resulting in times of severe suffering and want. In all business, capital is crucial to ameliorating the unforgiving cycles of prosperity and recession. Amid these economic uncertainties enters the Jewish moneylender, far more skilled and knowledgeable in the manipulation of currency and gold than his customers. There was little financial regulation of lending practices until fairly recent times, offering many opportunities for the unscrupulous. It should be made clear that the term usury means not simply a fair and moderate interest rate, but an excessive one. Usury would be what one would call today loan sharking, with exorbitant interest and compound interest rates. Usury, noun, one, the lending practice of lending money at an exorbitant interest, an exorbitant amount of rate of interest, especially in excess of the legal one, or three, interest paid for the use of money. Loan sharking, noun, the practice of lending money at excessive rates of interest. That's from Random House Webster's Unabridged Electronic Dictionary, 1996. Jews themselves understood the exploitive nature of their usurious practice on the Gentiles. Maimonides, who was considered the greatest European Jewish teacher, wrote the following in his important book of civil laws. Quote, "It is permissible to borrow from a heathen or from an alien resident and to lend him at interest, for it's written, thou shalt not lend upon interest to thy brother. To thy brother it is forbidden, but to the rest of the world it's permissible. Indeed, it's an affirmative commandment to lend money at interest to a heathen, for it's written, unto the heathen thou shalt lend upon interest." Nezik, biting, usury, and marbit, increase, interest, are one and the same thing. Why is it called nezik? Because he who takes it bites his fellow, causes pain to him, and eats his flesh. Now that's right from the Code of Maimonides, Book 13, Book of Civil Laws, Chapter 4, 1, 88 through 89. The usury practiced by the Jews of the medieval world is outrageous by modern standards. In A History of the Jews in England, Cecil Roth finds Jews charging interest rates between 22 and 43%. In northern France, the interest rate was limited to 43%. In 2006, the authorities tried to reduce the prevailing rate of 65% plus compounding. In The Jews of Poland, A Social and Economic History of the Jewish Community in Poland from 1100 to 1800, writer Bernard Weinrib shows similar outlandish rates in Poland in the 14th and 15th centuries. In the 1942 book, The Jews in Spain, Their Political and Cultural Life During the Middle Ages, the Jewish author A.A. Newman writes that in Castile, the authorities allowed Jews to charge an interest rate of 33 1/3%. When farmers desperately needed to purchase seed during the Great Famine in Suecia in 1326, the Jews refused to lend money unless they were allowed 40%. The most important political document from medieval England, and perhaps in the history of Western civilization, the Magna Carta, reveals the power of Jewish usurers by declaring that widows and orphans have first claim on estates over Jewish moneylenders. In the social life of the Jews of northern France in the 12th and 14th centuries, as reflected in the rabbinical literature of the period, Louis Rabinowitz notes how the Jewish usurers saw themselves and their occupation as far more profitable than farming or artisanry. Many Jewish historians have documented the tremendous wealth accumulated by the Jews through usury. Rabinowitz points out, for example, that the taxes on Jewish usury alone amounted to more than the rest of the ordinary royal revenues in France in 1221. King Louis XIX, who vigorously denounced the Talmud, had more concern over the Jewish economic predatory behavior. In 1254, he barred Jews from money lending and said that they should live by trade and manual labor. As an illustration of the far-reaching impact of Jewish usury, Achille Lucaire shows that in medieval Europe, even many churches and monasteries were closed because of debts owed to the Jewish moneylenders. Jacob R. Marcus, one of the world's leading Jewish historians, in his Encyclopedia Britannica article, Jews, states, quote, "The floating wealth of the country was soaked up by the Jews, who were periodically made to disgorge into the exchequer." Unquote. Gentile opposition to Jewish predatory economic activity, far from always being pathologic and hateful against Jews, was more often rational and compassionate. Today, loan sharking is viewed as a pernicious activity that deserves criminal prosecution. It has been also shown that in communities that limited such activity, anti-Semitism was also mitigated. Davidson quotes two patricians in the 16th century of Venice as saying that moneylending is the way that the Jews consume and devour the people of this, our city. The Venetian authorities eventually codified precise regulations of Jewish economic activity, including a maximum interest rate of 5% on loans. Brian Pullen quotes a rabbi of the times who, after elucidating the causes of anti-Semitism elsewhere, noted, quote, "Usury makes them unpopular with all the orders of the city, engaging in crafts with the lesser people, the possession of property with nobles and great men. These are the reasons why the Jews do not dwell in many places, but these circumstances do not arise in Venice, where the rate of interest is only 5%, and the banks are established for the benefit of the poor and not for the profit of the bankers." Arthur Kornberg and Theodore Herzl, from Assimilation to Zionism, quotes extensively from the founder of modern Zionism, Theodore Herzl, including fascinating parts of his diary. Herzl writes that anti-Semitism arising from Jewish financial domination was completely understandable, and he insisted that, quote, "one could not expect a majority to let themselves be subjugated by formerly scorned outsiders whom they had just released from the ghetto." In another section, he quotes Herzl as saying that Jews have been educated to be, quote, "leeches that possessed, quote, frightful financial power and were a money-worshipping people incapable of understanding that a man can act out of other motives than money." Herzl commented, quote, "I find the anti-Semites fully within their rights." Now, again, that is from the founder of modern-day Zionism. Modern Jewish writers on anti-Semitism never acknowledge the possibility that Gentiles have a basic right to defend themselves from frightful Jewish financial power and that anti-Semites could be fully within their rights. If a Gentile described Jewish financial predators as, quote, "leeches," even when such is acknowledged by one of the leading lights of Zionism, he would certainly be called an anti-Semite. Is it any wonder that a thoughtful Christian, such as St. Thomas Aquinas, who is considered a great exponent of love and charity, would also speak out against the Jewish practice of usury? Quote, The Jews should not be allowed to keep what they have obtained from others by usury. It were best that they were compelled to work so that they could earn their living instead of doing nothing but becoming avaricious. That's from Thomas Aquinas, Saint, 13th century scholastic philosopher. As I read more Jewish histories, I learned that usury was just one of the many predatory financial practices in the commercial sector that provoked opposition in the Christian community. Jewish commercial activities, that's the next section. Usury was the greatest source of Jewish power and certainly the wellspring of the Jewish banking families that dominated Europe for hundreds of years. But Jews also found profit in many other activities, both credible and contemptible. While Jewish religious teaching forbade usury to fellow Jews as a pernicious practice, it encouraged Jews to engage in usury against the Gentiles. The same principle extended to every economic competition between Jew and Gentile. Financial acumen combined with a powerful group cohesion and economic strategy provided powerful weapons in the battle for commercial dominance in Europe and later in America. The fact that Jews practiced a dual set of ethics, an altruistic one for themselves and a predatory one for Gentiles, contributed to their economic domination even in the more ordinary business endeavors. Many of the most egregious practices were condemned by a Jewish Frankfurt Synod of 1603 in order to prevent Hillul Hashem, disgrace of the Jewish religion. Quote, those who deceive Gentiles profane the name of the Lord among the Gentiles. Close quote. That statement has been much quoted by those who dismiss anti-Gentile financial measures as representative of a bygone era. However, a subsequent rabbinic responsa clarified the issue as a result of a dispute between two Jews who contested the spoils of the deception of a Gentile. It held that exploitation and deceit against Gentiles is permissible as long as Hillul Hashem does not occur. In other words, as long as the act does not damage the Jews as a group. Jacob Katz says, quote, ethical norms applied only to one's kind. Just as it is morally wrong to practice usury on fellow Jews and morally commendable to be usurious with Gentiles, it is decreed morally ethical for Jews to engage in profitable unethical acts toward Gentiles as long as they can do so without harming the Jewish community. Now, the following passage from the Vital Code of Maimonides clearly shows the dual economic morality in business dealings. It should not be forgotten that Jews consider Maimonides their greatest philosopher during the Enlightenment. Quote, a heathen cannot prefer charges of overreaching because it is said, one his brother. However, if a heathen has defrauded an Israelite, he must return the overcharge according to our laws, in order that the rights of a heathen should not exceed those of an Israelite. That's from the Code of Maimonides, Book 12, the Book of Acquisition. Jewish teachings commanded Jews to aid their brothers and not to compete with one another in attempts to exploit Gentiles. Jacob Katz traces a large body of Jewish literature forbidding competition between Jews. They are barred from interfering with monopolies controlled by other Jews and from underbidding fellow Jews. They were always to cooperate with other Jews in the face of Gentile competition, quote, so as not to lose the money of Israel, unquote. Next section is Jewish team strategy. It's difficult to overstate how Jewish economic solidarity, and when they deem necessary, economic boycott or hostility can injure commercial enterprise. In my chapter on media control, I discussed the well-coordinated Jewish takeover of the Gentile-owned Times Herald in Washington, D.C., which was accompanied by quietly having Jewish advertisers and agencies leave the Herald and drive it to insolvency, and then returning their revenue after the newspaper was safely in Jewish hands, such as indicative of the many ways that group strategy can have tremendous economic impact on almost any business enterprise. Take, for example, the impact that government has on almost any major corporation in America. Key bureaucrats can influence government contracts, environmental compliance, civil rights, tax liability, and regulations on items such as food and drugs. If a Jewish government administrator has a hostility toward a particular corporation or a vested interest in it, obviously it can have a tremendous impact on its financial health. If a Jew has an important corporate purchasing authority, he can choose to buy a product from either a Gentile firm or one owned by fellow Jews. His decision will have a profound effect, for good or ill, on the two entities. The Gentile, in his instance, has been conditioned to think that everyone must be judged on his or her merits, and it would be immoral to be biased for his own race. Furthermore, Gentiles learn that their primary mission is the good of the company or the government agency they serve. The Jew, on the other hand, has been conditioned from early life to think in terms of the good of his group and of Gentile perfidy from Pharaoh to Hitler. Is it any wonder that the Jewish manager is likely to choose the Jewish firm to fill the contract or the Jewish applicant to fill the important executive vacancy? Such actions might seem altruistic, but they're also self-serving, for just as he knows he will assist a fellow Jew when he can, he knows that somewhere along the line he will be assisted in the same way. A classic example of ruthless Jewish team business strategy was revealed in a 2001 study by Avner Halpern of MIT's Faculty of Business Administration. The Israeli Daily, Haaretz, had a story about Halpern's study called, quote, Why American CEOs of Israeli Firms Fail. It stated, quote, Lots of startups hired Americans as top executives in order to facilitate entry into the United States market, unquote. The gist of the article is that dozens of Israeli firms lured American executives to their firms as executive officers so as to get a jump start in American markets. Not surprisingly for anyone who understands the Jewish team ethics and strategy, all the Gentile hires, everyone, were fired after they had served their purpose. The Jewish Mr. Halpern blames the firings on cultural clashes between Jews and Gentiles, but the fact remains that in a study of over 90 firms, with 25% of them having hired a Gentile CEO, that the result, every one of the companies wound up firing their American CEO. While ever-increasing numbers of American firms such as Disney are taken over by team-aligned Jews, while Gentiles are told it would be wrong to discriminate against Jews or any other minority, Jewish firms work relentlessly to purge any potential Gentile interlopers. Historically, there are many examples of this team effort utilized for economic and political advantage. Roth discusses the appointment of a Murano Jew, Diego Arias de Villa, as state treasurer in 15th century Spain. The terms Murano and New Christian are used to denote Jews who falsely converted to Christianity while practicing Judaism covertly. Roth points out that through de Villa's influence, many other New Christians rose to high positions. He also shows that the Muranos also controlled all New World imports and exports as well as their distribution in Spain. If Roth is right and the Jews, as a closed syndicate, controlled all the trade during that period in Spain, would not that cause hostility from Gentile merchants all over Europe? The Jews used their common languages and organizations to gain a competitive advantage over Christians and Muslims in the Mediterranean region. In his book, The Jews of the Ottoman Empire and of the Turkish Republic, Stanford Shaw shows how Jews had a system of bills of exchange honored only by other Jewish traders and bankers, giving them a competitive edge. A case study in Opoto, Poland, during the 17th and 18th century by Gershon Hundert, called The Jews in a Polish Private Town, the case of Opoto in the 18th century, illustrates how the Jews came to dominate commercial life. There were constant complaints that the Jews refused to join the craft guilds, that they controlled the trade and prices of raw materials, that they imported finished goods into the town, undercutting the local Christian artisans, that they did not buy from Christians, that there were complaints that Jews had pushed Christians entirely out of commerce, with the result that Christian merchants were forced to move elsewhere. Hundert writes that Jewish domination of the town's commerce was almost complete, unquote. He also notes that Jews came to dominate all phases of the alcoholic beverage business, including its manufacturing, distribution, and retail. Some Jewish writers even implied that Jewish union leaders in America were more inclined to be conciliatory to management if their union membership was mostly Gentile rather than Jewish. If that is true, then one could presume that Jewish firms would be likely to get more favorable labor agreements than Gentile firms. One can easily see the powerful advantage such firms would have over their Gentile competitors. There are many ways that group cohesiveness and loyalty can corrupt and ultimately pervert supposedly free markets. Well, my friends, that's the end of the second part of The Roots of Antisemitism, Economic Exploitation, Chapter 7. And we will go into the next section, Banks and Stock Exchanges, in tomorrow's broadcast. And we will begin by a fascinating story of the House of Rothschild and how Meir Amschel and his sons grew up an enormous empire in European banking, and also a famous deception they used to gain control of a lot of British industry and business during that period. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been great to be with you, and I look forward to being with you tomorrow. Remember that your help and your support makes possible these broadcasts. This is a free book. I hope that you will take your time, and a free audio book. Hope you'll take your time to make sure your friends and relatives know that this book is available at this time. And please give us some support. Your financial support enables me to do the work that I'm doing, to travel, to speak, and to publish. Thanks so much. I appreciate so much your support, both moral and physical. And let's go forward and win this battle for freedom for all Europeans and Americans and truly all the people of the world, and hopefully move toward a better world for ourselves and our children. Thanks so much, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.